for dinner. Doesn't happen, right? There are four basic tastes in Western tradition: sweet, salty, sour, and bitter. There's a fifth in other parts of the world that is gaining traction in the West, both culturally and scientifically. It's called umami, and it's the savory flavor you find in aged and fermented foods, like miso, Parmesan cheese, or aged steaks. Most tastes are pleasing, and the evolutionary reason for them is simple. They attract us to foods that contain nutrients, as well as the salt and sugar that we need. Bitterness is different. Bitterness turns us off, which, as it turns out, is probably the point. A study published in 2005 by researchers working collaboratively at University College London, Duke University Medical Center, and the German Institute of Human Nutrition concluded that we evolved the ability to taste bitterness in order to detect toxins in plants and avoid eating them, which is why the plants produced the toxins in the first place and has led to the term many plant biologists use to describe them, antifeedants. By reconstructing the genetic history of one of the genes responsible for the growth of bitter taste receptors in our tongues, scientists have traced the evolution of this ability to Africa, sometime between 100,000 and 1 million years ago. Not all humans have the ability to taste bitterness, and not all are as sensitive to it as others. But given how widespread the ability is across the globe, it's pretty clear that tasting bitterness gave humans a significant survival advantage. About one quarter of humanity is even more highly attuned to taste. They're called super tasters, because they are. Chemists discovered them almost by accident while studying reactions to a chemical called propylthiouracil. Some people can't taste it at all. Some people find it to be mildly bitter. And some people, super tasters, find even the smallest taste to be repulsive. Super tasters find more bitterness in grapefruit, coffee, and tea. They may be as much as twice as sensitive to sweetness and are much more likely to feel the fire at a hint of chili. Interestingly, the same collaborative paper that linked bitterness to the detection of plant poisons noted that it may not be such an advantage today. Not every version of the compounds that taste bitter is poisonous. In fact, as I mentioned in the description of nightshade, some of these compounds are beneficial. The scopolamine in Jimson weed that causes temporary madness is a bitter-tasting alkaloid, but so are some of the compounds in broccoli that have anti-cancer properties. So today, especially in developed countries where the need for a natural alarm bell against plant toxins has pretty much faded away, it may be a disadvantage to have a strong reaction to bitterness. Now, instead of steering you away from poisons, it's steering you away from food that's good for you. With 250,000 plants to choose from and a keen sense of taste, why haven't we cultivated plants that aren't poisonous and bred the toxins out of plants that are? Well, we've tried. But like everything else in the evolutionary kingdom, it's complicated. And there are consequences. Remember, plants' chemical weapons aren't aimed at us, for the most part. They're directed more at insects, bacteria, fungi, and in some cases mammals that are dedicated herbivores. So if we impose unilateral disarmament on a plant, it's like giving the keys to the candy store to a busload of school kids. Pretty soon there's nothing left for anyone else to eat. The plant's predators just finish it off. Of course, sometimes plant breeders have gone the other way and bred in too much natural resistance, turning an otherwise edible food into an almost deadly poison. All potatoes contain solanine, especially those that are a little green in color. Solanine is also what protects potatoes from potato late blight. Imagine a deadly case of athlete's foot, and you'll get the idea of what blight means to a potato. Solanine is a fat-soluble toxin that can cause hallucinations, paralysis, jaundice, and death. Too many solanine-rich French fries, and you're French fried. Sometimes, of course, blight can overwhelm the protection solanine provides. The fungus was responsible for the devastating Irish potato famine in the mid-19th century that led to mass starvation, death, and emigration from Ireland. In England during the 1960s, plant breeders worked to develop a blight-resistant potato, in order to increase the efficiency of potato crops. They called their special spud the Lenape. The first person who ate a Lenape potato didn't feel very special, though. It contained so much solanine, it was nearly deadly. You won't be surprised to hear that they pulled those Lenapes from the market like hot potatoes. Celery is a similar case that sheds light on the sometimes double-edged nature of organic agriculture. Celery defends itself by producing sorolin, a toxin that can damage DNA and tissue, and also causes extreme sensitivity to sunlight in humans. The funny thing about sorolin is that it becomes active only when it's exposed to sunlight. Some insects avoid this poison by keeping their victim in the dark. They roll themselves up in a leaf, protected from the sun, and then spend the day chewing their way out. Garden variety celery doesn't pose a problem to most people unless you visit the tanning salon after a bowl of celery soup. Sorolin generally poses more of a problem for those who handle large amounts of celery over a long period of time. Many celery pickers have developed skin problems, for example. Now, the thing about celery is that it's especially good at kicking sorolin production into high gear when it feels under attack. Bruised stalks of celery can have 100 times the amount of sorolin of untouched stalks. Farmers who use synthetic pesticides, while creating a whole host of other problems, are essentially protecting plants from attack. Organic farmers don't use synthetic pesticides. So that means organic celery farmers are leaving their growing stalks vulnerable to attack by insects and fungi. And when those stalks are inevitably munched on, they respond by producing massive amounts of sorolin. By keeping poison off the plant, the organic celery farmer is all but guaranteeing a biological process that will end with lots of poison in the plant. Life. It's such a compromise. Now that we have a better understanding of the relationship that plant evolution has on humans, let's take another look at the connection between fava beans and favism. What do we know so far? We know that eating fava beans releases free radicals into the bloodstream. We know that people who have favism, with a deficiency in the G6PD enzyme, lack the ability to mop up those free radicals, which causes their red blood cells to break down and results in anemia. We know that a map of fava bean cultivators and a map of likely favism carriers would highlight the same portions of the globe. And we know that any genetic mutation as common as favism, more than 400 million people, must have given its carriers some advantage over something even more deadly. So what's a threat to human survival that is common in Africa and around the Mediterranean and has a connection to red blood cells? 4 out of 5 dentists may recommend Trident, but 10 out of 10 infectious disease experts will give you the same answer if you ask them to solve that riddle. The answer is malaria. Malaria is an infectious disease that infects as many as 500 million people every year, killing more than 1 million of them. More than half of the world's population live in areas where malaria is common. If you're infected, you can experience a terrible cycle of fever and chills, along with joint pain, vomiting, and anemia. Ultimately, it can lead to coma and death, especially in children and pregnant women. For centuries, starting with Hippocrates' treatise on airs, waters, and places, doctors believed many diseases were caused by unhealthy vapors emanating from still water, lakes, marshes, and swamps. They called these vapors, or mists, miasma. Malaria, which is Old Italian for bad air, was one of the many diseases they thought miasma caused. The association with hot, wet swamps turned out to be correct, but because of the mosquitoes that thrive in those areas, not the vapors they emit. Malaria is actually caused by parasitic protozoa, microscopic organisms that share some traits with animals, that are deposited in the human bloodstream through the bite of female mosquitoes. Males don't bite. There are a few different species that cause malaria, the most dangerous of which is Plasmodium falciparum. The theory that miasma causes malaria was wrong, but it led to the development of at least one modern comfort many people would sweat to lose. According to James Burke, the author of the Connections series, A Florida doctor named John Gorey thought he had malaria licked in 1850 with the help of a new invention. Dr. Gorey correctly noticed that malaria was significantly more common in warmer climates. And even in cooler places, people seemed to get sick only in warmer months. So he figured if he could find a way to eliminate all the warm, bad air, he could protect people from malaria. Dr. Gorey's malaria-fighting contraption pumped cool air into the malaria hospital ward. Today, a version of his invention probably pumps cool air into your home. You call it an air conditioner. And while the air conditioner didn't improve the prognosis of any of Dr. Gorey's malaria-infected patients, it has had an impact on the disease. Air conditioning allows people who live in malarial parts of the world to stay inside with their doors closed and windows shut, which helps to protect them from infected mosquitoes. There are still hundreds of millions of malarial infections every year, and while it's one of the 10 highest causes of death in the world, not everybody who gets infected dies. Even more to the point, perhaps, not everybody who gets bit by malaria-carrying mosquitoes gets infected. So what's helping the malaria survivors? J.B.S. Haldane was one of the first people to understand the idea that different environments impose different evolutionary pressures, producing distinct genetic traits that in certain populations cause disease. More than 50 years ago, he suggested that certain groups, specifically people with a genetic tendency for sickle cell anemia or thalassemia, another inherited blood disorder, had better natural resistance to malaria. Today, many researchers believe that a genetic trait far more prevalent than sickle cell anemia or thalassemia may also provide protection against malaria, G6PD deficiency. In two large case-controlled studies, researchers found that children with the African variant of the G6PD mutation had twice the resistance to P. falciparum, the most severe type of malaria, that children without the mutation had. Laboratory experiments confirmed this. Given a choice between normal red blood cells or G6PD deficient red blood cells, the malarial-causing parasites preferred the normal cells time after time. Why? P. falciparum is actually a delicate little creature. It only really thrives in nice, clean red blood cells. The red blood cells of someone with G6PD are not just less hospitable to malaria, they are also taken out of circulation sooner than those of people without the mutation, and that disrupts the parasite's life cycle. This explains why populations exposed to malaria would select for favism. What it doesn't explain is why those populations would also cultivate fava beans. What's the point in living through a mosquito's breakfast if your own lunch can kill you? The answer is probably straightforward. Redundancy. Malaria is so widespread and so deadly that vulnerable populations needed every possible defense in order to survive and reproduce. By releasing free radicals and raising the level of oxidants, fava bean consumption makes the blood cells of non-G6PD deficient people a less hospitable place for malarial parasites. With all the free radicals, some red blood cells tend to break down. And when someone with a mild or partial deficiency in G6PD eats fava beans, the parasite is in deep trouble. As far as partial deficiency is concerned, remember that the genetic mutation that causes favism is only passed on the X chromosome. And remember that females have two X chromosomes. This means that in populations where the mutation is common, many women have a red blood supply that is partially normal and partially G6PD deficient. That gives them additional protection against malaria, but doesn't make them vulnerable to an extreme reaction to fava beans. And considering that pregnant women are very vulnerable to malaria, it's a good thing that many women can have their favism and eat it too. Humans have been relying on herbal remedies since, well, probably before there were humans. Archaeologists have found evidence suggesting that Neanderthals may have used plants for healing 60,000 years ago. The ancient Greeks used opium milk, which is the fluid that oozes out of the opium poppy when it's slashed, as a painkiller. Today, we derive morphine, one of the most powerful painkillers available, from the same place. The first really effective anti-malarial medicine came from the bark of the cinchona tree. George Cleghorn, a Scottish army surgeon, is one of those credited with discovering the anti-malarial properties of cinchona bark early in the 19th century. But it still took another century before French chemists isolated the specific beneficial compound, quinine, and made a medicinal tonic from it. The tonic tasted awful, though, so legend has it that British soldiers mixed their gin rations with their tonic treatments. And presto, a classic was born. Tonic water still contains quinine today, but unfortunately, if you're going to travel somewhere that malaria is prevalent, you still need a prescription for your anti-malarial drug. Just about every strain of malaria has become somewhat resistant to quinine. Good thing we have those helpful fava beans. Eat your vegetables. Your vegetables can kill you. Mother Nature is sending mixed messages again. The truth, as you've no doubt gathered, is complicated. Many plant toxins can be good for us. The trick is understanding how they work, how we work, and how it all works together. Those phytoestrogens that can cause sterility? It looks like genistein, the phytoestrogen in soy, might help to stop or slow the growth of prostate cancer cells. Some researchers think the same compound may ease the effects of menopause, which could explain why Asian women report far fewer problems with midlife changes. Capsaicin, the hot in hot peppers, stimulates the release of endorphins, which induce feelings of pleasure and reduce feelings of stress. Capsaicin also increases your metabolic rate, some think by as much as 25%. Even more, there is a growing body of evidence that capsaicin may be helpful in alleviating pain caused by everything from arthritis and shingles to post-operative discomfort. The list goes on. The sorolin in celery can cause skin damage, but it is also a real help for people with psoriasis. Allicin, which comes from garlic, prevents platelets in your blood from sticking together and becoming clots, which makes it a potentially powerful weapon against heart disease. The aspirin a day that keeps the doctor away? It started out as a chemical in the bark of willow trees to keep the insects away. Today, it's a virtual drug of all trades, a blood-thinning, fever-reducing pain reliever. Taxol? The powerful anti-cancer drug is another tree bark derivative. In this case, from the bark of the Pacific yew. Around 60% or more of the world's population still relies directly on plants for medicine. Probably isn't such a bad idea for us to drop in every once in a while, take a look at what they're cooking, and wonder why. Chapter 5. Of Microbes and Men. For thousands of years, a parasitic worm called Dracunculus medinensis, which means little dragon, has plagued humans across Africa and Asia. It causes a terrible disease. The larvae of the worm, also known as guinea worm, are eaten by water fleas that fill ponds and other sources of still water in remote tropical areas. When people drink the water, their digestive system destroys the fleas, but not the larvae. Some of the larvae migrate from the small intestine into the body, where they grow and eventually mate with each other. About a year after infection, adult females, now 2 to 3 feet long, about the diameter of a piece of spaghetti, and full of new larvae themselves, make their way to the skin of the person carrying them. Once they get to the surface, these female guinea worms begin to secrete acid, effectively burning themselves an exit tunnel. The first sign of infection is the appearance of a painful blister. Soon after the blister appears, it ruptures painfully, and the worm starts to make its way out. The burning caused by the acid drives the human host to seek relief in cooling water. And as soon as the worm senses water, it emits a milky fluid full of thousands of larvae to begin the process anew. Worms can sometimes be removed surgically, but for millennia, the only effective treatment has been to wrap the worm around a stick and slowly, carefully pull it out. The process lasts for many painful weeks or months and can't be hurried along too quickly. If the worm breaks, the infected person can experience an even more painful and serious reaction, perhaps even death. Guinea worm has afflicted humanity for centuries. It's been found in Egyptian mummies, and even thought to be the fiery serpent that ravaged the Israelites during their 40 years in the desert. Some scholars think the rod of Asclepius, the snake wrapped around a staff that is a symbol of medicine, was originally a simple drawing that early doctors used to show they offered help to remove the worms by wrapping them around a stick. Today, because we understand how the guinea worm manipulates its victims to collaborate in the infection of others, the little dragon's fire is on the verge of being extinguished. Former President Jimmy Carter has led a two-decade effort to spread understanding about the parasite's method of reproduction to every corner of the world, ensuring that its victims avoid water when looking for relief, and that its potential victims avoid water that could be infected. According to the Carter Center, the worldwide incidence of guinea worm infections had dropped from 3.5 million in 1986 to just 10,674 in 2005. By understanding how the guinea worm has evolved in relationship to us, we have the chance to protect people from it. If you've come this far on our journey across the evolutionary landscape, you've probably gathered a good sense of the interconnectedness of, well, just about everything. Our genetic makeup has been adapting in response to where we live and what the weather's like. The food we eat has evolved to cope with the organisms that eat it, and we've evolved to cope with that. We've looked at the way we've evolved to resist or manage the threat posed by specific infectious diseases, like malaria. But what we haven't discussed yet is how all those infectious diseases are evolving right along with us. Make no mistake, they are. And for the exact same reason that we've been evolving for millions of years, too. At the end of the day, every living thing, bacteria, protozoa, lions, tigers, bears, and your baby brother, shares two hardwired imperatives: survive, reproduce. Now, in order to really understand the relationship between humans and the millions of microbes living beside us, you have to discard the notion that all bacteria are bad, all microbes are marauders, all viruses are villains, all... Okay, you get the point. The truth is that we have been evolving in tandem with all of these microscopic organisms, often to our mutual benefit. The way our bodies work today is directly related to our interaction with infectious agents over millions of years. Everything from our senses, to our appearance, to our blood chemistry, has been shaped by evolutionary response to disease. Even sexual attraction has a connection to disease. Why is the scent of someone you find sexually attractive so alluring? It's often a sign that you have dissimilar immune systems, which will give your children wider immunity than either of their parents. Of course, it's not just external organisms we've evolved to manage or that have evolved to manage us. Guess what? You may not have sent any invitations, but as you read this, you're playing host or hostess to a massive party of microbes. In fact, if your body's a party and your cells are the guests, you're outnumbered in your own home. An adult human contains 10 times as many foreign microbial cells as mammalian cells. If you put them all together, you'd find more than 1,000 different types of microbial creatures weighing about 3 pounds and numbering somewhere between 10 trillion and 100 trillion. And when it comes to genetic material, it's not even close. The microbes that make you their home collectively contain 100 times as many genes as your own genome does. Most of these microbes are found in the digestive system, where they play crucial roles. These intestinal bacteria, or gut flora, help to create energy by breaking down food products we otherwise couldn't break down. They help to train our immune systems to identify and attack harmful organisms. They stimulate cell growth, and they even protect us against harmful bacteria. In fact, the digestive problems many people experience when taking antibiotics are directly related to the loss of these healthy bacteria. Using broad-spectrum antibiotics is like carpet bombing. They kill everything in their way and can't tell the difference between enemies, allies, and innocent bystanders. That's why many doctors recommend eating yogurt when taking antibiotics. The bacteria in yogurt are friendly, probiotic, and they can help to provide some of the digestive assistance and protection that is normally performed by the gut flora until they get back to normal levels. Not all the bacteria who have made you their home are so friendly. Right now, you may be providing a human roof over the metaphoric heads of Neisseria meningitidis, Staphylococcus aureus, and Streptococcus pneumoniae, the bacteria that can cause, respectively, meningitis, toxic shock syndrome, and pneumonia. Fortunately, the millions of microscopic allies in your gut have also taken it upon themselves to keep the bad guys under control. Through what's called the barrier effect, colonies of gut flora prevent these dangerous bacteria from growing to dangerous levels by dominating the resources in the digestive tract. The helpful bacteria actually work with our own bodies to ensure that harmful bacteria can't gain a microscopic foothold. To provide a similar effect, some doctors advise women who are prone to yeast infections to take probiotics, either by eating them in foods like yogurt or by taking a supplement. Just as they do in the digestive system, probiotic-friendly bacteria act as naturally occurring helpful bacteria and create a barrier effect that inhibits the growth of vaginal yeast. One of the reasons some probiotics are friendly has to do with their taste in metals. Remember how almost every form of life on Earth needs iron to survive? Well, one of the exceptions is also one of the most common probiotics, a bacterium called Lactobacillus, which uses cobalt and manganese instead of iron, which means it's not hunting yours. Your digestive system is a veritable jungle with hundreds of species of bacteria competing for survival, most of them working with you, but a few of them ready to work against you if they have the chance. When the relationship between an organism and the host it inhabits is mutually beneficial, as is generally the case with humans and intestinal bacteria, it's called symbiotic. Often, of course, that's not the case. The guinea worm is a pure parasite. It lives off its human host for its own benefit, providing nothing, causing only harm. And when its victim feels the natural urge to plunge the sores the worm causes into cool water, and thus help the worms to spread, the infected person is experiencing a type of host manipulation, the phenomenon that occurs when a parasite provokes its host to behave in a way that helps the parasite to survive and reproduce. By examining some of the most extreme examples of host manipulation in nature, we can gain a better understanding of how parasites can affect our own behavior. So, before we continue our exploration of the relationships among humans, microbes, and our mutual evolution, let's take a trip back to the actual jungle to examine a real-life invasion of the body snatchers. Spider body snatchers, anyway. Plesiometa argyra is an orb-weaving spider native to Central America. Orb weavers are a large family of spiders with more than 2,500 different species spinning webs around the world. True to their name, these little guys spin those familiar circular webs with bullseye centers. The fellow we're concerned with, along with his special relationship to a parasitic wasp called Hymenoepimysis argyrophaga, has been the subject of serious study by a scientist named William Eberhard. Because these insects only have Latin names, let's call the spider Thane of Cawdor and the wasp Lady Macbeth. Cawdor lives a happy life in the Costa Rican jungle, spinning orb-shaped webs, hunting the prey that happened to stumble into his home and wrapping them up for later consumption. Then one day, Lady Macbeth flies up, seemingly out of nowhere, and stings him. Cawdor is paralyzed. Now the wasp lays an egg on the spider's abdomen. 10 to 15 minutes later, Cawdor awakens and goes about his business, spinning webs and trapping prey. Little does he know that from the moment Lady Macbeth first laid her stinger on him, he was as doomed as his namesake. The egg deposited by the adult wasp soon hatches into a larva. The larva, let's call it Baby Macbeth, makes holes in the spider's abdomen and slowly feeds off its blood. Over the next few days, the wasp larva lives off the spider, and the spider spins on, oblivious. Then, when the larva is ready to cocoon and begin the final phase of its transformation into an adult, Baby Macbeth injects Old Cotter with chemicals that completely change the spider's behavior, effectively turning it into the larva's slave. Instead of building circular webs, the spider now goes back and forth over the same few spokes, retracing its steps as many as 40 times as it builds a special web to protect the larva's cocoon. Then, near midnight, Mother Nature can definitely lay on the drama, the spider sits down in the center of this special web and doesn't move. All that's left is for Baby Macbeth to finish the job. The larva kills the motionless spider and basically sucks it dry. When it's finished its meal, it discards the spider's lifeless husk on the jungle floor. The next night, it spins a cocoon around itself, which it hangs from the reinforced webs built by the dead spider, and enters the final phase of its growth. Around a week and a half later, an adult wasp emerges from the cocoon. Researchers aren't entirely sure how the larva hijacks the spider's instinctual web-building behavior. To be clear, it's not that the spider is behaving in a completely new and different way. The steps it repeats to build the special cocoon web are essentially the first two steps of the five basic steps involved in building a normal web. It just repeats them over and over again, like some kind of looping music track stuck on repeat. Dr. Eberhard says, "The larva somehow biochemically manipulates the spider's nervous system, causing it to perform one small piece of a subroutine, which is normally only a part of orb construction, while repressing all the other routines." Dr. Eberhard's research also made it clear that however the biochemical injected by the larva works, it works quickly and lasts a while. In laboratory studies, when the parasite is removed from the spider after it has started to build the cocoon web, but before it is finished, that is, after the larva has asserted mental control, but before it kills the spider, our arachnid friend continues to build the cocoon web for days, until it eventually returns to building normal webs. Nature abounds with examples of host manipulation. Generally, no big surprise here, they involve a critical step in the parasite's efforts to reproduce. In the case of many parasites, that boils down to this. How do I get from this host to the next one? Before we turn back to parasites that manipulate humans, let's look at a parasite that faces a particularly vexing transportation problem. Dicrocolium dendriticum is a tiny worm that lives in the livers of sheep and cattle. It's commonly called a lancet liver fluke. If you and your family lived in a sheep and you didn't want your entire species to die out when the sheep died, you'd have to find a way to get your kids into the gut of another sheep. When adult flukes lay eggs, those eggs are passed by their hosts in dung, where they remain dormant until a land snail comes along to feed on the dung, eating the eggs in the process. Once eaten, the eggs hatch inside the snails, and eventually the newborn flukes are excreted from the snail as slime. Ants feed on the slime and become a new ride for the flukes in the process. But there's still a long road ahead. Think about it. You're riding in an ant, and you need to get into a sheep. What to do? As the worms being carried by the ant develop, one of them makes its way to the ant's brain, where it manipulates the ant's nervous system. Suddenly, the fluke-hosting ant behaves in completely uncharacteristic fashion. Every night it leaves its colony, finds a nice blade of grass, and climbs to the tip, where it hangs on and, apparently suicidal, waits to be eaten by a grazing sheep as it munches on the grass. If it's not eaten, it returns to its colony during the day and finds another blade of grass the next night. Eventually, when the ant is eaten along with its blade of grass, the flukes make their way from the digestive system of their new host and colonize another liver. The parasitic hairworm Spinocordides tellinii grows to adulthood inside grasshoppers in the south of France. It's another worm that, like a house guest that will never leave, makes its host suicidal. As soon as the hairworm larva reaches adulthood, it releases specialized proteins that convince the unfortunate French grasshopper to find the nearest pool of water and jump right in, like a drunken sailor docked in Marseille who has forgotten that he can't swim. Once in the water, while the grasshopper is drowning, the worm slithers out and swims off to find romance and reproduction. Remember, bugs and worms aren't the only organisms capable of host manipulation. Viruses and bacteria engage in sophisticated host manipulation all the time. The rabies virus is an interesting example of host manipulation on more than one level. The rabies virus colonizes the salivary glands of its host, making it difficult to swallow. That's what causes the characteristic foaming at the mouth. The inability to swallow makes the animal's mouth froth with, not coincidentally, rabies-filled saliva. By the time the animal is foaming at the mouth, the virus will most likely have infected its host's brain, where it chemically induces the animal to feel higher and higher levels of agitation and aggression. When animals are agitated and aggressive, they bite. When their mouths are foaming with rabies-filled saliva, their bites are infectious. Angry bite plus infected saliva equals new host, which means survival and reproduction for the virus. The origin of foaming at the mouth as an idiom for angry and aggressive behavior isn't the only piece of culture we've gotten from rabies. It's very likely that the werewolf myth, in which one bite transforms the victim into a possessed beast just like the biter, almost certainly has its roots in ancient observations of the rabies virus at work. Enslaved spiders and suicidal grasshoppers are examples of host manipulation at its most extreme. Janice Moore, a professor of biology at Colorado State University who has studied host manipulation for more than 25 years, notes that, in some cases, the change can be so dramatic that the infected host is essentially transformed into another creature. It is possible that the parasitized animals are frequently so altered compared with their uninfected counterparts that they well may be the functional equivalent of a different species. On the other hand, many host manipulations are more subtle and at least seem to be natural. Notice, even in the case of the orb-weaving spider and the wasp larva, it's not that the larva actually assumes complete control of the spider. Rather, through chemical manipulation, it gets the spider to behave in a way that is more to the larva's benefit than the spider's. But the spider is still alive and volitional. The two steps of the web-building routine, after all, belong to the spider, not the wasp. Similarly, when people infected with guinea worm plunge their hands into a cold pool to relieve the pain, the guinea worm isn't actually controlling their minds, of course, but it has evolved to stimulate its host to behave in a way that helps it survive and reproduce. The good news for us is that we're a lot smarter than spiders. The more we understand how parasites manipulate their hosts, especially when their hosts are humans, the more we can manage those effects and control the outcome. Sometimes the only effective option may be to stamp out the behavior that allows the threatening parasite to reproduce, as in the case of the guinea worm. Sometimes, as you'll soon see, we may be able to steer the parasite's evolution in a more benign, or at least less harmful, direction. There's ample evidence of that in the evolutionary record, after all. Just think about all those bacteria in your stomach helping you to digest that pint of Häagen-Dazs you shouldn't have eaten for lunch. Toxoplasma gondii is a parasite that can infect just about every warm-blooded animal, but can reproduce in a way that guarantees its survival only in cats. T. gondii reproduces by copying itself during the life of its host, but it's only in cats that it undergoes sexual reproduction, producing new oocysts, or spore cells, that can go on to find new hosts. Infected cats distribute oocysts in their droppings. The oocysts are hardy little organisms that can survive for as long as a year in tough conditions. When rodents, birds, or other animals ingest the oocysts, they become infected. Animals can also become infected by eating the flesh of an infected animal. humans can ingest oocysts by eating undercooked meat or poorly washed vegetables or after handling cat litter. Once an animal is infected, the T. gondii cells are distributed through the body by the bloodstream, where they insert themselves inside muscle and brain cells. It's a pretty nasty-sounding infection. Who wants parasites setting up permanent shop in your brain? But it's thought to be generally benign in most people, although more on that shortly. It's also incredibly common, infecting as much as half the world's people, and not just where you might think. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, in the United States, scientists think that more than 20% of the population is infected. In France, it's nearly 90%. Some epidemiologists think there's a correlation between raw meat consumption and T. gondii infection rates, which might somewhat explain the high level of French infection. Tartare is a French word, after all. None of which explains how T. gondii gets back into a cat. Well, that's where the story gets interesting. T. gondii is a master little host manipulator of mice and rats. When a mouse or a rat eats infected cat droppings, the parasite behaves in the usual manner, moving into the mouse's muscle and brain cells. Once inside the mouse's brain, in ways that are not completely understood, the parasite has a profound effect on its behavior. First, the mouse becomes fat and lethargic. Then it loses its natural fear of predators, of cats. In fact, some studies have shown that instead of fleeing areas marked with cat urine, infected mice are actually drawn by its scent. You know what the scientific term is for a fat, slow mouse that is attracted by the smell of cats? Cat food, which gets T. gondii exactly where it wants to go. We mentioned a moment ago that T. gondii is thought to be largely benign in humans. Well, that is largely the case, but not always the case. First of all, people with severely compromised immune systems, like people living with HIV, are at risk for serious complications, as they are with many infections that people with a fully functioning immune system can manage. Those complications can include blindness, damage to the heart and liver, and inflammation of the brain, called encephalitis, which can lead to death. The other group that has to be on the lookout is pregnant women. Depending on how far along she is, if a pregnant woman becomes infected, there can be as much as a 40% chance the fetus will become infected, and that can cause similar severe complications. This risk doesn't exist if a woman is already infected, that is, if she became infected at some point before she became pregnant. There's only a risk to the fetus during the phase of initial infection. But for that reason, pregnant women and people who have compromised immune systems should avoid raw meat and let somebody else empty the litter box. There is also increasing evidence that past infection with T. gondii, toxoplasmosis, may trigger schizophrenia in some people. E. Fuller Torrey, a renowned psychiatrist and schizophrenia researcher, publicized many of these theories in 2003. It seems clear that there is a higher incidence of T. gondii infections in schizophrenics, although it isn't yet clear what causes what. T. gondii may be a schizophrenia trigger, but it's also possible that people with schizophrenia are more likely to engage in behavior that exposes them to T. gondii, like poor hygiene. It's certainly an area that deserves serious exploration. Just a decade ago, scientists dismissed the idea that infections could cause ulcers. Today, that's a proven fact. Of course, the doctor who proved the connection, Dr. Barry Marshall, had to swallow bacteria and give himself an ulcer before the experts would take it seriously. Sometimes there is justice, though. Dr. Marshall, along with his colleague J. Robin Warren, won the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 2005 for their discovery. The notion that T. gondii may trigger schizophrenia is supported by recent studies demonstrating that mice that have toxoplasmosis modify their behavior when given antipsychotic medication. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University are now testing whether schizophrenics might be helped with antibiotics that fight toxoplasmosis. If Dr. Torrey is right, and T. gondii infection can trigger schizophrenia, it will add a whole new meaning to the stereotypical picture of the crazy cat lady. Given T. gondii's dramatic influence on rodent brain chemistry, It's not surprising that scientists have looked for evidence that the parasite influences humans as well. And there is evidence that people who have T. gondii infections do exhibit some subtle differences in behavior when compared to uninfected people. Again, it's not clear whether T. gondii is causing the behavior or whether people with these behavioral tendencies are more likely to be exposed to T. gondii. But it is interesting. One dedicated researcher, Professor Jaroslav Flager of Charles University in Prague, has discovered that women infected with T. gondii spend more money on clothes and are consistently rated as being more attractive than women without the infection. Flager summed up his findings this way. "We found they, infected women, were more easygoing, more warm-hearted, had more friends, and cared more about how they looked. However, they were also less trustworthy and had more relationships with men." Flager found infected men, on the other hand, to be less well-groomed, more likely to be loners, and more willing to fight. They were also more likely to be suspicious and jealous, and less willing to follow rules. If it turns out that T. gondii does influence human behavior in any of these ways, it's likely to be an accidental effect of the parasite's evolved manipulation of rodents. That's part of the reason why the possible effects in humans seem so much subtler than the effect in rodents. The manipulation is designed to get rodents to be eaten by cats, because that's where T. gondii's primary life cycle occurs. The infection of humans and other animals is more or less gravy for the parasite. The chemicals T. gondii evolved in order to affect the behavior of rodents may also have an effect on our brains. But whatever effect they do have isn't host manipulation in the evolutionary sense, because it doesn't do anything for the parasite, unless you know about a species of cats that only eats well-dressed women. Most people think of sneezes as symptoms, but that's really only half the story. A normal sneeze occurs when the body's self-defense system senses a foreign invader trying to get in through your nasal passages and acts to repel the invasion by expelling it with a sneeze. But sneezing when you've got a cold? There's obviously no way to expel the cold virus when it's already lodged in your upper respiratory tract. That sneeze is a whole different animal. The cold virus has learned to trigger the sneezing reflex so it can find new places to live by infecting your family, your colleagues, and your friends. So yeah, sneezes are symptoms, but when they're caused by a cold, they're symptoms with a purpose, and the purpose isn't yours. That's true for many of the things we think of as symptoms of infectious disease. They're actually the product of host manipulation, as whatever bacteria or virus has infected us works to engage our unconscious assistance in making the jump to its next host. As many people who have children know, pinworm infection is one of the most common infections contracted by children in North America. The CDC believes that somewhere around 50% of American kids probably have pinworms at any given point in time. Adult pinworms are no more than half an inch long and look more or less like a small piece of white thread. Pinworms grow to maturity in the large intestine, where they feed on digestive matter and eventually mate. During the night, pregnant females make their way out of the large intestine, the same way everything else does, and deposit their microscopic eggs on the skin of the infected child. At the same time, they deposit allergens that cause serious itching. They don't usually cause any damage except the itching, but those worms definitely want your child to scratch that itch. When a child who has pinworms scratches his or her bottom, the eggs get lodged underneath his or her fingernails. Without serious scrubbing every morning, including underneath fingernails, it's easy for those eggs to get around. They're sticky little things, and they easily make their way from fingers to everything the child touches. Doorknobs, furniture, toys, even food. When other children touch those surfaces, they pick up some eggs. Eventually, those curious fingers make their way into mouths, and some eggs are ingested orally. Worms hatch in the small intestine, migrate to the large intestine, and begin the cycle again. Pinworms only live in humans. Contrary to popular belief, they can't be caught from any other animal, although their eggs could easily be picked up from the fur of a pet that had been touched by a person with eggs on his or her fingers. Their survival requires movement from human host to human host, and they've evolved a simple and efficient method of host manipulation to help them make the trip, scratch and spread. Other diseases cause symptoms that manipulate us in more passive ways, all in the name of easing their ability to spread and reproduce. Cholera is a waterborne disease that causes severe diarrhea. In serious cases, the persistent diarrhea can cause dehydration and death. But like the itching caused by pinworms and the sneeze caused by the cold, the diarrhea caused by cholera isn't just a symptom, it's a transmission channel. It's how the disease makes it into the water supply and ensures its ability to find new hosts. Malaria manipulates human hosts too, in its case by incapacitating us. People with malaria experience a terrible cycle of fever and chills, accompanied by debilitating weakness and fatigue. And when you're lying in bed too tired even to lift an arm, you're a pretty helpless target for mosquitoes. Mosquitoes bite infected humans and pick up a load of malaria-causing protozoa. And then these bugs, carrying bugs, fly away to infect someone else. The study of host manipulation in humans is very young, but it's already revealing some surprising insights that promise new insights into the causes and potential cures of an enormous range of disease. We've discussed the possibility that when T. gondii jumps from cats to cat owners, it may sometimes trigger schizophrenia. Recent, although controversial, research shows the possibility of a connection between obsessive-compulsive disorders and streptococcal infections in children. The family of streptococcal bacteria is responsible for a wide range of human disease, from strep throat to scarlet fever, bacterial pneumonia, and rheumatic fever. Many types of streptococcal bacteria exhibit a phenomenon called molecular mimicry, in which they display characteristics of human cells in order to trick the immune system. The cells these bacteria mimic include cells found in the heart, the joints, and even the brain. When you have a bacterial infection, your immune system produces antibodies to attack the invaders. When the invaders are partially disguised through molecular mimicry, they can cause an autoimmune disorder. The immune system recognizes the threat posed by bacterial invaders, but the antibodies it produces attack all the cells that resemble the bacteria, including the body's own cells. That's how some children who have rheumatic fever end up with heart problems. Antibodies attack the heart valve because the infecting bacteria resemble it in some ways. Dr. Susan Sweeto, a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health, believes that certain strep infections can trigger an autoimmune disorder that leads to an antibody-led attack on the basal ganglia, the part of the brain believed to control movement. Researchers call this condition PANDAS, pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorder, associated with streptococcal infection. Parents of children with PANDAS describe heartbreaking transformations, often overnight. Shortly after infection, children suddenly display repetitive tics and uncontrolled touching, as well as serious anxiety. It's not clear that this is actual host manipulation. That depends on whether the change in behavior helps the bacteria to spread. Theoretically, of course, it's not hard to imagine how uncontrolled, repetitive touching of toys, furniture, and other kids would help the virus to spread. It's also possible that there is a relationship between obsessive-compulsive disorder and strep infections that isn't host manipulation itself, but the byproduct of the bacteria's effort to fool the immune system. One thing is clear. We're just beginning to understand the myriad ways our behavior is affected by infectious agents. One very new avenue of research is exploring the striking possibility that sexually transmitted diseases may actually influence sexual behavior. Now, I'm not suggesting that this kind of influence will transform a happily married man into an insatiable cheat. In fact, that wouldn't necessarily be in the viruses, or funguses, or bacteria's interest. Too much promiscuity on the part of the host could disable it with other, potentially more damaging diseases. And that would leave the parasite stuck in a host that couldn't get around. From the sexually transmitted parasite's point of view, it may want you to have more sex, but not too much sex. As for diseases influencing human sexual behavior, some researchers are examining the possibility that genital herpes may affect human sexual feeling in a way that could influence behavior. to researchers at the Department of Anatomy and Neurobiology at the University of California at Irvine, Carolyn G. Hatalski and W. Ian Lipkin, have speculated that the herpes virus may heighten sexual feeling because it is so intertwined with the nerves that carry those feelings. They wrote, "It is intriguing to speculate that the ganglion infection may modulate sensory input to sex organs, leading to increased sexual activity and enhanced probability of virus transmission. In other words, sometimes the herpes virus may want you to get some action." Host manipulation occurs when a parasite or disease affects our behavior for its own ends. But that's not the only way disease affects human behavior, of course. There are thousands of ways in which personal, cultural, and social standards have evolved in order to help us avoid or manage disease. Some behavior is instinctual, like the sense of disgust at certain sights and smells, which prompts us to avoid animal waste or spoiled food, things that are usually ripe with infectious material. Others are learned behavior and social pressure. Covering your nose and mouth when you sneeze is a good example. Washing your hands before a meal is another. All of these reactions to disease are called behavioral phenotypes, the observable actions of an organism that result from its attempt to manage the interaction between its genetic makeup and its environment for its own benefit. A few evolutionary psychiatrists, scientists who study human behavior in the context of evolution and look to see whether specific behavior conferred an evolutionary advantage, have even suggested that humankind's instinctual fear of strangers may have its roots in disease avoidance. The theory is rooted in the notion that in humans, two of our basic biological imperatives